This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Jay Powell, of course, because it's a Fed week. Also, though, dog leashes and single-speed bicycles. Not in the same story. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 20th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Interestingly enough, this was a week when what the Federal Reserve did was less relevant than what Chair Jay Powell said. There were other things said about this and the global economy this week, and so now we are going to say some things. We being Gina Smilek at the New York Times. Kate Davidson is at the Wall Street Journal. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Gina, let me start with you and Chair Powell, and I want your reaction to this thought. The idea that does seem to be gaining strength out there, that the more Jay Powell talks, the less clear the Federal Reserve's intentions about this economy are. Discuss.
I think that might have been a little bit what he was going for this week.
Really?
So, yeah, I kind of think I was talking to a bunch of investors about this yesterday and today. And I think that the consensus is that he didn't do that bad of a job this week. So basically, Powell has a kind of tough job right now because they're setting policy based on trade policy, which is highly uncertain, and you just never know what's going to happen with it. And so I think what the Fed wanted to communicate this week was just that they don't know what happens next. They haven't decided for sure. They think it could be a rate cut. They don't know when that's going to come, and they don't want to guarantee that it is going to materialize. And so I think Powell went out trying to convince the markets that they really don't know, and I think he was pretty successful at doing that.
Wow. Kate Davidson, what do you make of that? And also this growing idea, it's coming from the head of the ECB, and it's coming from the OECD. We did a story yesterday on how people are beginning to say, look, fiscal policymakers, that is politicians, you got to do something because bankers can't do it all. Central bankers.
Yeah, I think that Gina's absolutely right. You know, I thought one of Jay Powell's responses was kind of funny. He was sort of asked, when do you know whether you're at the point where you need to cut rates further or when you've cut them enough? When he sort of said, well, we'll when we've done enough, we'll stop.
Right.
I mean, he really didn't give. I think it was intentionally vague. But yes, on the fiscal policy front, Powell joins a long line of Fed chairmen and women who have argued that fiscal policymakers need to do more if they want to see more economic growth, that the Fed can only do so much to sort of support GDP. And their goals are maximum employment and stable inflation. And generally, that leads to, you know, pretty good economic growth. Mm-hmm. If things start to go south, though, you know, the Fed doesn't have some sort of magic tool that they've just been holding on to that we don't know about that's going to juice everything. Fiscal policymakers need to be thinking about the effects of their policy. And so, you know, specifically right now, we're talking about trade. That's weighing on things.
Gina, let me ask you this about a report that came out from the New York Fed today. It basically said, oh, look, consumers are still strong. Businesses aren't doing much. The question has to be, how long does that endure? And I know I ask this a lot, but holy cow.
But I mean, it's the fundamental question about this business cycle, because the consumer is 70% of the American economy and they haven't cracked yet. And that's why we have seen such, you know, really persistently solid growth here. And I think the big question is, how long can that persist? Because what we've seen is some hints around the edges that consumers are getting a little bit spooked by the trade war. You know, the University of Michigan survey looked weak last month, and the preliminary September numbers showed a little bit of a bounce back, but it wasn't the bounce back you would have hoped for. And so I think the real question is, you know, those surveys tend to correlate pretty poorly with spending, but if you would see it bleed over into actual activity, then you've got a problem on your hands.
Kate, about trade and consumers, the president said today at one of those joint press conferences he does with visiting heads of state, this was the Australian prime minister, head of government, I suppose. Somebody will correct me, I'm sure. He said, you know, I don't think I need a China trade deal before the election. If you do the regression analysis and take the politics out of that, do you buy it?
I don't know. I think that we'll know a lot. Let's say that there's not some agreement when Chinese officials come in early October. That's sort of the next big development. Yeah. They're going to come to Washington. If there's no progress made then, you know, as of now, the U.S. is still scheduled to raise tariffs on October 15th on a bunch of consumer goods. We already have tariffs on $360 billion of imports from China. So, excuse me, not consumer goods on the 15th, right. But by December 15th, there's another round that would sweep in a bunch of consumer goods. I mean, at that point, we'll be having tariffs on almost everything from China. And it's hard to imagine. You just talked about the effect on consumers. It's kind of hard to imagine that, you know, being sustainable through an election year. So I have to think that at some point the administration accepts some kind of deal.
Okay. So, Gina, I want to do one last thing with you. You've got, and this is going to sound ridiculous, you're going to have 45 seconds to do it. This thing that's been happening in the what's called the overnight repo market, right? These banks lending to one another super short term in order to make their books work out. We did an interview on it on Wednesday. It's incredibly weedy. But the reason I'm asking is that the New York Fed said today it's going to keep making these emergency overnight monies available until the 10th of October. Are you stressed about this or is it normal-ish?
It's not normal, so I think it's important to recognize that. But it's not a reason for outside stress. So basically what happened is the Fed has been shrinking its balance sheet for a long time, which we've talked about.
Yep.
And they got to a point where at very unusual moments when a lot of cash comes out of this market really quickly and there's a liquidity crunch, bank reserves used to step in to fix that.
Right.
But now bank reserves are scarce enough because of the Fed's balance sheet shrinking that they're not doing that. And so the Fed finds itself having a couple of options. It can keep doing these emergency operations, which it doesn't want to do. It can basically offer an option to banks where they can switch treasuries for reserves, which it's talked about, but it's not there yet, and it would take a while to implement. Or it can keep growing its balance or start growing its balance sheet again just a little bit. And so it's really going to be sort of a debate over which of those is sort of your least worst option.
Least worst is how we're going to leave this thing. Holy cow. Gina Smilek of the New York Times and Kate Davidson of the Wall Street Journal. Thanks, you two.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you.
We'll see you. Have a good weekend. On Wall Street this Friday, it was fine until about lunchtime, then some trade-induced indigestion. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, trade as promised. Talks did pick up again in Washington today. Mid-level, we're told, so it's not like a deal's coming tomorrow. But there were some notices published in the Federal Register today that seem hopeful. The Trump administration has exempted hundreds of items from the 25% tariff list that go into effect in the middle of next month. So as we have in the past throughout the program today, we are going to do a couple of harmonized tariff schedule explainers, imports that are off the hook. Today, here's number one.
Single-speed bicycles having both wheels exceeding 63.5 centimeters in diameter, weighing less than 16.3 kilograms without accessories, and not designed for use with tires having a cross-sectional diameter exceeding 4.13 centimeters.
And that is Harmonized Tariff Schedule heading
8712.00.2500.
That's Mehdi Farsi. He's the co-founder of State Bicycle Company in Tempe, Arizona. They specialize in those single-speed bikes. How's he feeling today?
Definitely takes a big weight off of our shoulders.
The company's about 10 years old.
You know, when we applied for the trade exemption, we figured it would be a long shot, if not, you know, completely ignored.
Can't give away your shot.
We're going to kind of take the news with a grain of salt, but it definitely gives us at least more flexibility in our options going forward.
And?
If there's a takeaway for this, I guess it means, you know, no matter how big or how small you are, just you try to make your voice heard and try to clearly state your case. And you never know, you might end up on top.
Mehdi Farsi from the State Bicycle Company in Tempe, Arizona. More from the Harmonized Tariff Schedule coming up. To quote a little Shakespeare by way of setting up this next story, 'tis no sin for a man to labor in his vocation. Falstaff, Henry IV, part one for the scholars among you. Setting aside that Falstaff was talking about thievery there, Shakespeare almost certainly was not taking into consideration whether the person doing the labor was an employee. The National Labor Relations Board is set to propose a rule that says graduate students at private colleges who work on campus, often as researchers or teaching assistants, that they are not, in fact, employees, including the ones teaching the Bard. And that is even though a lot of the work that graduate students do is only loosely related to their field of study, their vocation, if you will. Marketplace's Ben Bradford looks at whence that decision came.
Rithika Ramamurthy is a fifth-year English PhD student at Brown University who researches 19th-century novels, but she says she has to teach literature centuries removed from her studies.
I am assigned without my input or my consent to a professor that needs a teaching assistant.
She says that makes her both a student and an employee, deserving of a contract and worker protections. University of Oregon labor professor Gordon Lafer agrees. He says universities have grown increasingly reliant on grad students, to their detriment.
While in graduate school, they are the cheap labor force, and when they graduate, they discover that there's no jobs because the tenure-track jobs have been replaced by grad students and adjuncts.
But university administrations say the teaching and research are part of the education. Labor attorney Shannon Farmer works with colleges and universities.
It is so intertwined in their experience as a graduate student, as preparing them, you know, to get their PhDs, whether they plan on going into industry, whether they plan on going into academics.
That's the Labor Relations Board's justification for its new proposed rule, that grad students aren't employees. But this will be the fourth time the board has changed that determination since 2000. Based on who's in the White House. With the U.S. approaching another election year, Farmer says the Labor Board's proposing a rule that would take more effort to repeal. I'm Ben Bradford for Marketplace.
There's a lot of trade on the program today, China trade and tariffs. Here's another T word, tomatoes from Mexico. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra explains what's going on there.
The U.S. imports about $2 billion worth of tomatoes from Mexico every year. And for a long time, American farmers have accused Mexican farmers of dumping cheap, low-quality tomatoes into the U.S. They say that makes it hard for them to compete. Christopher Sands directs the Latin American Studies Program at Johns Hopkins.
A customer who doesn't care that much might say, well, I can get twice the tomatoes for a low price. Maybe I should go with that.
Yesterday, the U.S. government and Mexican tomato growers finalized a deal to end this dispute. It changes the way the U.S. Commerce Department inspects tomatoes from Mexico. It'll create a new inspection process to keep out low-quality tomatoes. Gustavo Flores Macias, who teaches government at Cornell, says that might limit consumers' options.
If only the highest quality tomato is coming in, that will also be the most expensive tomatoes. So U.S. consumers might end up having to pay for that. Highest priced tomatoes out there.
And retailers that sell tomatoes, like Walmart, have criticized the deal, saying the inspections could delay shipments of tomatoes, allowing them to ripen and possibly rot. Michael Gunderson teaches agricultural economics at Purdue University.
Tomatoes are a highly perishable product, so you're more likely to have some tomatoes that don't reach the end consumer, which would add to the cost potentially.
The Commerce Department says it'll generally complete inspections within 24 hours. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
As we return to our journey through the imports now exempted from the U.S.-China trade war, there were a whole lot of different things on the lists that were published today. Imported Chinese plastic drinking straws, they're good to go. Certain kinds of grills, indoor tabletop water fountains, also
dog harnesses and retractable dog leashes.
We called a guy who knows a thing or two about them.
The tariff code in question, 4201.00.3000, applies to dog leashes, collars, muzzles, harnesses, any equipment that you would use to keep your dog under control when you got him out for a walk or for exercise purposes.
That's Mike Bober. He's the president and CEO of the Pet Industry Joint Advisory Council. He's feeling pretty good that leashes and muzzles and harnesses and whatnot imported from China are not going to have that extra 25% tariff.
I hate to say it. My response was, that's a great start.
But
The truth is, this is just one of hundreds of lines that we need to see exempted that have no real strategic implications in the back and forth trade negotiations between the United States and China.
One more item from today's tariff exemptions yet to come. Coming up,
you had to use GPS and avalanche monitors and that sort of thing.
Team building, corporate style. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is down 159 points today, about a 0.5%, 26,935. The NASDAQ down 65 points, 0.8%, 81.17. The S&P 500 shaved off 14 points, 0.4%, 29.92, the number there. For the week, come on, aviation people. Barometer settings? Let's go. For altimeter settings, rather. For the week, the Dow dropped 1%, the NASDAQ down 0.7, the S&P 500 off about a 0.5%. On this day of worldwide climate protests, a look at renewable energy companies. The Danish firm Vestas Wind Systems blew down 0.2%. Today, the Indian wind turbine company Suzlon spun up more than 0.3%. Canadian solar boosted 0.4% today. Bond prices, well, they rose. Thanks for asking. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.71%. And you are listening to Marketplace. Marketplace helps you stay sharp on all things related to business and the economy. And to help you do some numbers of your own, you can get your very own Marketplace pencil pack when you become a Marketplace investor today. It's a set of 6 pencils, each stamped with a different Marketplace quote, yours for a donation of just $5 a month. So please support public service journalism and get your pencil pack today at Marketplace.org. And thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal with the United Auto Workers in the fifth day of their strike against General Motors. A story from Missouri now, and a GM worker to whom Tracy Samuelson introduced us a couple of months ago. Lincoln Fegley was offered a choice when GM shut down its plant in Lordstown, Ohio. Take the layoff or move to another plant. Lincoln and his family moved, basically just in time for the talks. Here's Tracy.
Most afternoons, Lincoln Fegley works on the dashboards of new vehicles on GM's assembly line. But one afternoon this week, he and his wife, Melissa, were in the school pickup line, waiting for their daughter, Serenity.
I take it I just get in line to pick her up?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay.
You did get in line. Yeah, I didn't know the first day I came.
This is my first time picking her up because I work second shift. So unless I see Serenity in the morning, I don't pretty much see her at all until my one day off.
Serenity stayed late today for drama club.
I know you're trying to get rid of me, but that's not the way.
The past few months have been a whirlwind. Lincoln moved out to Missouri in April and bought a new house in June. Serenity and Melissa stayed in Ohio to finish out the school year. They all love their new house, but haven't really had the chance to settle in.
This is going to sound crazy. We really haven't had time to do anything. Like, he just came off of a 12-day streak where they didn't have a single day off.
So the strike, it's almost a chance to take a breath.
It's a sucky reason to have him home, but it's really nice.
It's also a chance to do some things around the house. Lincoln spends the evening changing the oil in both their cars.
I wish I remembered how much oil this thing actually takes.
During the strike, everyone in Lincoln's union local has to do 1 4-hour shift a week, helping at the union hall or picketing. He wants to do more.
It's time to show them what we're made of.
Like many workers, Lincoln wants GM to reverse some of the concessions the union made to help the automaker get through the financial crisis, like allowing a 2-tier wage system and foregoing cost of living pay increases. But most importantly, Lincoln wants GM to make its temporary workers permanent.
That's a huge issue. I spent 4 years as a temp before finally getting hired, and there are people here that have been temps for 5 years.
Temps make less money, don't get benefits, and can take very limited time off unpaid.
You know after 90 days whether you want somebody to stay on or not. It's just abusive. It's just wrong.
On the picket line, Anita Haynes says she's been a temp for a little over a year. She likes the work, but doesn't like that she's treated differently.
Whether you're a temp or permanent, you're human.
I don't know about that.
If you work in 8 to 12 hours a day building a product, and when it comes time, some profit sharing, you don't get anything. That's like a slap in the face.
GM workers say the strike is a sacrifice they're willing to make, but they only get $250 a week in strike pay. Melissa and Lincoln Fegley haven't had the chance to save much recently, with all the expenses of moving and buying a new house. They say they'll be okay for a few months.
It gets that bad, I'll start selling collectibles. I haven't.
I don't need to be institutionalized in that. That bills are already going to be climbing amount of bills if this thing goes on a long time. So.
Right.
But they're hoping the strike doesn't last that long. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Last up from today's list of tariff exemptions, that is stuff we import from China that is not going to have a 25% import tax slapped on it.
Miniature lighting sets of a kind used for Christmas trees.
According to the Census Bureau, during the 2017 holiday season, 85% of Christmas tree lights hung with care. Yes, I know that was stockings, but anyway, 85% of the Christmas tree lights, around $400 million worth, were imported from China. So, happy holidays. The American office is changing. We all know that. But that, in turn, is changing what happens when we all leave the office together for a company thing. Alex Williams wrote about company outings for the New York Times, how they are not exactly what they used to be. Alex, welcome to the program.
Hey, great to be here.
I'm just going to quote you back to yourself in the lead paragraph of this article, and then we will discuss. Here's what you write. Forced fun at the corporate level may represent the last best hope for human interaction among coworkers. Really?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the general take I got when I was reporting this story is that for years, these office outings, whether they be retreats or trip to the bowling alley or the ball game, they were kind of like canned fun. There was something you did to make the boss happy, and it was something you sort of got through, and a lot of people would prefer just to not do them at all. But actually, the way I think that the American office is changing, that it's becoming the last place where we actually talk. I mean, we're in an environment now where people spend all day long, you know, slacking with people who sit right next to them. In my department, people sit around with giant headphones to drown out other people. And that's when people come in at all.
Should try working in a radio shop, pal. That's all I'm saying. That's all I'm saying.
Exactly.
So look, we're not talking about a couple of people going out for beers after work, right? It's organized by the company, and it's kind of you got to show up.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's certainly at the retreat level. I mean, when senior executives go off to a mountain retreat, it's very mandatory. And even if it's all supposed to promote teamwork and togetherness, I mean, there's a necessary element of competition. You're still performing for the boss.
Right. So look, there are many variations on this. The one that hit me from this piece was a trip that I think it was LinkedIn people took to like a ski place or something. Tell me that story because it's bananas.
Oh, yeah, it's nuts. I mean, I think the basic idea is that everybody did get sick of these sort of juvenile trust-building exercises. And I think especially in Silicon Valley, where they're all about pushing themselves to the limits, there's this San Francisco-based company called Adventure Architects, which is all about basically making like extreme fun for offices. And one of the things they did was on a mountain retreat, they were up in the Sierras. And one morning, there's a frantic knock at the cabin door, and you got pulled into a ritualized search and rescue mission for a missing skier. I mean, it was all a game, of course.
Yeah, but
GPS and avalanche monitors and that sort of thing.
Right, but the LinkedIn people didn't know it, right? I mean, the way I read it in the piece was there was an urgent banging at the door. Come on, we lost a guy, blah, blah, blah. And everybody's like panicked.
Well, I think they quickly got clued in.
Oh, all right. Okay. All right.
I don't think it was too much panic. But, you know, even so, the whole thing was pretty intense up until the very end when they sat around with the corporate coach to evaluate their performance over a nice dinner and wine. But even then, you're being graded. It's not exactly, I don't know.
Right.
not exactly a party.
That's exactly it. Given, you know, the premise of technology and all of that shutting us off from our coworkers, it only gets worse, right?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I look at the American Office as sort of an anachronism. I mean, you know, we're all used to watching the show The Office, and it's sort of like, it's a family, it's a dysfunctional family, but, you know, you spend all day long shoulder to shoulder with this big cast of characters. But, you know, increasingly, for all the reasons I mentioned, it's very easy to not even know who you're working with. So I can see some reason to have some sort of forced event to throw us all together.
Alex Williams, writing in the Style section in the New York Times about corporate fun on kind of a mandatory basis. Alex, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
This final note on the way out today, in which Walmart reads the regulatory handwriting on the wall. We plan to discontinue the sale of electronic nicotine delivery products. That's from the statement this company's biggest retailer put out this morning, e-cigarettes, of course. It's going to sell down its inventory, probably be done with that by January. Regular cigarettes will still be available. This is the second big social policy move Walmart has made. It said it's going to stop selling handgun ammunition and ammunition that can be used in assault rifles a couple of weeks ago. Okay, we're going. Dow Industrial's down 159 today, about a half percent. The NASDAQ down 65 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500, 14 points to the offside, 0.4%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday. Everybody, have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.